Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Eli Merritt. He is a political historian at Vanderbilt University, where he researches the ethics of democracy, the interface of demagogues and democracy, and the founding principles of the United States. He writes a Substack newsletter called American Commonwealth, and today we're focusing mostly on his edited book, How to Save Democracy, Inspiration and Advice from 95 World Leaders. So, Dr. Merritt, welcome to the show. It's a big pleasure to have you on.
Great to be with you, Ricardo.
So, I guess that if we are interested in saving democracy, at least in the context of your book, I think it would be nice to start by asking you what democracy really is, because of course we use the word every day frequently, but perhaps as a political historian, you can tell us exactly what we are talking about when we use the word democracy.
Well, that's a great question, and I would like to be able to tell you exactly what it is, but I think there is some dispute about it. But let me tell you what's so wonderful that not only are you leading off with that question, but you're asking that question at all, because for this book, How to Save Democracy, and my recent history book, Disunion Among Ourselves, I probably in the past year have done probably 40 or 45 interviews and podcasts. And no one has asked me that question exactly the way you did, so simply, what is democracy? And the reason I'm underscoring this is so important is I really do think that after the troubles that we've had in our constitutional democracy in the past 10 years, this is the fundamental question we need to be asking. We need to go back to the drawing board and make sure we understand what democracy is. So in answer to that question, I'll start and we can continue the conversation. I'll start by saying, let's imagine that democracy is a house, and that underneath that house are four cornerstones. And one mistake I think that we have begun to make in our democracy, perhaps in part because we call it democracy when it's something much more complex than that, is many people think that the four cornerstones underneath the house of democracy are: one cornerstone is the will of the people, the next cornerstone is the will of the people, the third cornerstone is the will of the people, and the fourth cornerstone is the will of the people. And this is an egregious mistake. What the word democracy now means is something very complicated, more in the fashion of a ethical, constitutional, representative democracy, which essentially depends upon ethical leadership. And so there is some debate about what we would call the four cornerstones, but I would suggest that democracy is that house with four cornerstones underneath it, and one of the essential cornerstones is the will of the people, meaning the vote of the people, meaning that democracy is government of, by, and for the people. But that's just one cornerstone. The other co-equal cornerstones, which must constantly interact and balance the will of the people, are constitutionalism and the rule of law. That's a second fundamental pillar or second cornerstone. And then another is ethical leadership. Perhaps the most important one is ethical leadership. And then a fourth I would name that I think we really need to begin to talk about every day, 24/7, is checks and balances. Checks and balances are as important to the success of a constitutional democracy as the will of the people itself. So I would start off with you here today, Ricardo, answering your question about what is democracy and saying it's a house on those four cornerstones.
But those are the four cornerstones. But are there specific political values that are associated with democracy?
There are values which we pursue that are an inherent part. You could put them one place or the other under the ethical cornerstone or under the constitutionalism. But of course, the things that we're striving for and that has made the democracy continue to evolve, although haltingly in a positive direction, are the fundamental political values we pursue, for example, of justice, equality, and freedom. Those are some examples of the political values. I think we can think of, what are the political values that we're constantly aiming for, but then we can also think of what is the underlying structure of the democracy that helps to hold it together. that helps it from becoming corrupt, which helps it from to resist the ever perennial force of demagogues and authoritarians in the attempt actually to tear or knock the house of democracy down.
And what would you say are perhaps the main virtues or strengths of democracy? Because, of course, since we are talking here about saving democracy, later on in a bit we're going to get into some of perhaps the flaws and weaknesses, but to start with the strengths here.
Perhaps. The strength or the virtues, yeah.
Yeah.
I think so many. We can discuss a few of those. And again, to describe a little bit more what this, you know, a book is, How to Save Democracy, Advice and Inspiration for 95 World Leaders, I'll say that I put this together about a year ago, a little over a year ago, after the first Summit for Democracy organized by Biden and Harris. And their predominant reason for organizing the Summit for Democracy, which was attended by a little over 100 leaders, I think was to try and create a global sense of unity and a discovery of what the global values of democracy were. And certainly that was the case, but I took particular interest in this, again, first Summit for Democracy and also the second one, but this book is based on the first one. I took a particular interest because I'm always simply trying to learn about democracy, better understand democracy. And I think we've reached a juncture in our history of a nation which has really, I think, to a fault, practiced a sense of exceptionalism within itself. I think the time has come for us to begin to really understand other successful democracies of the world. And so that's the origins of the book and my pursuit of this type of learning. And so with that in mind, you know, I will, when you ask me that question, I initially think that during that first summit, the president of Switzerland, you know, said that democracy is the greatest revolution that has ever happened in human history. And so why is democracy so fundamentally important as a form of government as opposed to the other forms of government? You know, one is that it supports the autonomy and self-actualization and freedom of human beings more than any other form of government. Certainly, when it's working well, it is a form of government which engenders the least oppression against the people and, again, the most freedom. And critically, it is a system that, again, when functioning successfully, certainly dissent, the name of your podcast is The Dissenter. Dissent is a fundamental part of what democracy is, but that dissent rarely tips over into actual violence. So it is the most nonviolent form of government that is available to us as well. So those are some examples of what are the virtues of democracy. And I'm also reminded in describing that I think it was just in the past couple of days that Merrick Garland was on 60 Minutes, and he told a powerful, very emotional story. I was very surprised. He teared up many times during that because he was recalling that his family and his heritage had come to the United States, many persecuted in the Holocaust, several died in the Holocaust. And so what he emphasized was this is the form of government, and our particularly American democracy is the form of government which has offered people protection from oppression, and of course the worst type of oppression, which is loss of life or death. And so he really emphasized that this is a peaceful form of government, and of course we're all very troubled at this current time to worry about the political violence that happened on January 6, 2021, other forms of political violence which are a direct result of demagoguery within our political figures, most importantly Trump, also within our media, most importantly Fox News and some conservative radio. So we have to get back to civil discourse and begin to mitigate the real dangers of demagoguery. People think demagoguery is just kind of loudmouth political, but it is a very dangerous thing. A speech of violence precedes violence.
Yes, and we're going to address some of the perhaps biggest current threats to democracy that we are experiencing nowadays. But tell us perhaps a little bit more about what you consider to be the biggest flaws and weaknesses of democracy.
Well, I'm glad you bring that up because that takes me straight to my area of greatest research and writing, mostly public writing, a lot of op-eds in the Los Angeles Times, one op-ed in the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, and others. You know, if you'd asked me this question 20 years ago, what is one of the greatest weaknesses of democracy? I would have said, you know, inefficiency. Democracy is filled with checks and balances. It's designed, when designed well, to prevent abuse of power. And so we have so many, I mean, even just look at our government with two branches of legislature, which have to balance one another, and there are checks on one another. And then you have a presidential veto, et cetera, and you've got the court system. So there's inefficiencies in democracy, but that is a minor, minor weakness when compared to the most fundamental flaw or weakness in democracy that goes directly back to Athenian democracy in the 5th century BC. And that is what we can think of as an Achilles heel of democracy. And that is speech, in fact. Our most prized commodity is speech, but speech, when it turns demagogic, and it allows a demagogue who is an incipient authoritarian, when a demagogue rises to power and the democracy does not successfully thwart, by all means legal and constitutional, when we do not thwart the rise of a demagogue like Donald Trump, who is a textbook case of a demagogue, and in our history he would definitely qualify as the supreme American demagogue. That's the fundamental flaw, is that democracy allows for free speech and allows for rhetoric, but sometimes if we're not careful, if we do not exercise appropriate checks and balances against the rise of demagogues, something catastrophic happens, like that demagogue can enter the most powerful political post in the country and in the world, and that's the White House. And we've seen how dangerous that is. And the favorite talk I've been giving over the past few months is called Alexander Hamilton's Theory of Democratic Collapse. A president commences a demagogue and ends a tyrant. That comes from the Federalist Papers, of course, which were written after the adoption of the Constitution, or the drafting of the Constitution adopted by the Federal Convention in 1787. And that comes from the Federalist One of about 85 or 86 total Federalist Papers. In Federalist Number One, Hamilton has the wisdom to teach his contemporaries and us still today. The critical thing to do in a republic or a democracy is to beware of demagogues. You have to keep them out of the system. And so I'll end, you know, the answer to this question that you've asked, Ricardo, by saying that they instituted a lot of checks and balances to prevent specifically demagogues from emerging to the Oval Office. And unfortunately, a bit ignorant of how democracy works, we have neutralized those over the years, to the point that until the early 1970s, the most important check against the rise of demagogues was the political parties. And they were pretty successful. The political parties acted as critical filters to prevent demagogues from proceeding through the national conventions every 4 years into the general election. Well, there's a lot of reforms which took place, which actually added more democracy, removed a check and balance, and added more democracy to the primaries. And now the political conventions and the political parties are uber weak. They do not have the power to stop a demagogue from being nominated in their conventions, because they have decided simply that whatever plurality that a candidate like Trump receives in the states crowns him or her, in this case him, to be the nominee. So You can become the nominee of a political party in the United States now if you're Stalin. You can be a demonstrated tyrant. You can be a demonstrated authoritarian demagogue, which by now, with no malice towards Trump, I'm just describing him as a political actor. He is an authoritarian demagogue. So he's going to emerge again, because we have a very flawed democracy, because we have not had the wisdom to really understand that we must maintain always safeguards that prevent demagogues from emerging to power in parties, and then into, most critically, the general election of the presidential election every 4 years.
But do you think that some of that lack of safeguards is something intrinsic to democracy and is always something that will be there, ever present, or it is just the way that some of our flawed democracies have been set up.
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer to that, based on my understanding from my reading experience and also from that of others, is the fact of demagogues and demagoguery is an essential part of the democratic process. So at no point can you ever make certain that demagoguery is being practiced or that demagogues will not try to push their way into the political mainstream. So they'll always be there. So there's a constant competition between what I think of as the forces of ethical constitutional democracy and the forces of let's say, corruption, demagoguery, and authoritarianism. So the question is, which side is going to win out? Ethical constitutional democracy, or again, the forces of corruption, demagoguery, and authoritarianism? And that now, Thomas Jefferson said something equivalent to eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. So we must practice that eternal vigilance, and we must actually now we must really recognize that what's happened here in the United States with the election of the first authoritarian demagogue, the first demagogue into the White House, this is a real a wake-up call for us. This is a cautionary tale, and so it is. In every adversity, there's a silver lining, and the silver lining here would be to learn from our contemporary challenges in a technological a world where communications take place in nanoseconds, and also understand these things, go back to understanding what democracy is and how it works with checks and balances, and embark upon reform. So, in answer to your question, it's a very good point. You don't design a great democracy and have no further challenges with demagogues and demagoguery. But we certainly have made a fatal mistake in our democracy. And I would say that those two most fatal mistakes are that we allowed. It is mistakes made based upon, I believe, ignorance and lack of understanding about how democracy works that let Trump get into office. We also made fundamental mistakes with regard to news media back in the late 80s with the emergence of Rush Limbaugh after the revocation of the Fairness Doctrine by the FCC. I believe that was in 1987. So codes of ethics and ethical behavior by the watchdogs and fundamentally important democratic institutions is essential. You can't have a dog-eat-dog, laissez-faire democracy. You can't have it. It just will fail. And if we continue to get demagogues into positions of power, we will lose our democracy. I will state that with 100% certainty. If we do that, we will lose our democracy. So we need to get ahead of that and get back to the forces of ethical constitutional democracy triumphing. And what to do about the Republican Party is a great, difficult question. Even Mitt Romney recently said, to paraphrase, the majority or a large majority of the people in my party do not abide by or put the Constitution first. So we got real troubles here today. I'm sure you agree, Ricardo.
Yes, but talking about some contemporary issues we're going through, as you look at democracy and democratic countries across the globe, what would you say, or what do you think are some of the biggest current threats to democracy?
Well, I can review some of what we were just talking about. I do think, and I've learned it from many sources. It started for me with Alexander Hamilton's Federalist Number One. But this threat, this Achilles heel of demagogues gaining access to democracies, is that fundamental threat throughout the entire world, as far as I can see. I mainly study the American system and the founding of the United States. But I stay aware and abreast somewhat, like other folks, of what's going on in the world. And to put that in other terms, it is the advent of different modes of speech which permit demagoguery to travel at the speed of light. So the internet, mobile communications, the breakdown of any sort of authoritative media and news media in particular. We often say media, but they're the most important institution of democracy. That's important is we need to get to the truth, and we need to get to the truth about the political process. So when you have demagoguery and disinformation and, frankly, outright lying, in general, it's pernicious for a society or a democracy. But in particular, if we think of some of the things that Trump has pursued and that the Republican Party has acquiesced in and sometimes pursued itself, what we find is there's demagoguery and disinformation about the most sensitive aspects of a democracy. And those are elections. When there are lies about elections, people begin to lose their trust in a democracy. When there are lies about the news media, people begin to lose their trust in the media. And so these, I believe, are the fundamental threats that a big emphasis of this summit for democracy, the first summit, was, you know, it used to be that we lost democracies because military leaders would get in tanks and they would roll into the nation's Congress or executive mansion and simply take over. And we know that takes place to some extent now, but it is widely known among political scientists and widely discussed at the Summit of Democracy that the way that we're democracies are being overthrown is very different. And it is this pathway in which a demagogue, through primary elections in the United States and some other countries, emerges as a presidential candidate and then wins the presidency. And this is often not really very democratic because at least the primary system, it's on plurality, not on majority, and gains access to deep presidential power. And then what happens? A demagogue is already lacking a moral compass, but we all know that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And then what happens is, which the January 6th committee demonstrated in our country, is that demagogue who is very willing to ignore the Constitution becomes even more flagrant in the abuses of the democracy and converts into authoritarianism. That's exactly what Hamilton said wisely in 1788 in this paper, Federalist One, is beware demagogues because they become tyrants. And so in today's vernacular, we would say they become authoritarians. So I can't remember who it was at the first summit, which is quoted in the book, who said, basically, to paraphrase again, disinformation is a bullet that strikes right at the heart of democracy.
But talking about some of those contemporary challenges to democracy, one of them that we've been seeing recently in the US in particularly, but not exclusively, it's also been happening across other democratic countries in Europe, for example, and elsewhere, is a backlash against some basic democratic values like diversity, equity, inclusivity. How do you look at this? Where do you think it comes from, and how worried should we be about it?
Well, I view the advancement of the progressive causes over the past 10 or 15 years, perhaps something that's been, you know, doubly troubling and causing more backlash than normal to conservatives, and that's conservatives are generally against progress of the nature that is discombobulating to them. It's happened so very fast. I do think that change is happening at a more rapid pace than it has in the past, and causes are being advanced much more rapidly and perhaps much more loudly than they have in the past as well. And so progress is really one of the aspects that constitutional democracy is all about, progress. And it's all about advancing rights. It's all about equality. And so a lot of these causes you described with diversity, equity, and inclusion, it's a source of progress that's being pushed hard and fast. And I think the other side, meaning conservatives, are reacting with backlash, as you have described. And I would dare say that tension between progress and liberalism and conservatism and backlash is present since, I guess, you know, just after the Neanderthals, when the first political societies were forming. So I think it's always there. It's a question of how it is handled and managed. Do we get to hyperpolarization where, with the help of Trump and demagoguery over the past 10 years, we develop, as you know and your listeners understand too, that the opposing sides, the liberal side and the conservative side, begin to consider one another to be mortal enemies rather than in a best case scenario, colleagues who have ideologies with which I significantly disagree, but we understand that one fundamental aspect of democracy, we could perhaps people can name it as a cornerstone, is compromise. So when folks have relationships and they recognize that the way we settle our differences is through peaceful compromise, then you get to an outcome, as we all know, in negotiation, the compromise, where neither side is completely happy, but at least we're experiencing an advancement or movement forward with regard to settling the challenging political and economic issues that a government has to settle.
So another kind of question I would like to ask you now is, so we've been talking about the strengths and weaknesses of democracy and some of the contemporary challenges to it. How is democracy maintained?
How is democracy maintained? Yeah. When you initially asked me that, I'm reminded of the Thomas Jefferson quotation I stated earlier, and that's, you know, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. So how is it maintained? It's a very complex dynamic, I believe, how it's maintained. First and foremost, I think citizens are educated about democracy, what democracy is, about the Constitution and what the Constitution is, about the essential nature of democratic of dynamics like the separation of powers and checks and balances. And then, of course, the education can never start too early with parents and family members engaging young people in democratic processes, essentially from birth, you know, going to the polls, joining civic societies. But then also when we get into school, it is well known and understood that an education in basic civics and basic ethics and also history, the history of the world, but specifically the history of democracies and how they've worked and how they've not worked, and also examples of the opposite, which would be authoritarian regimes, oppressive regimes. Education in that way, I believe, and in history in particular, because history is one of our greatest teachers, K through college, I think, is quite essential. So one way we maintain that is to try and specifically educate the public, and most importantly, the voting public, not only in reading, writing, and arithmetic, but again, civics, ethics, and history. But that's only one thing. I will further state, though, that it is my belief that human beings are, no matter how well educated, are uniquely vulnerable to the influence of demagoguery and demagogues. And by that, I mean an individual who is not standing up and in the attempt to win political office and offering rational, although perhaps vehement and passionate discourse about what the policy should be and what policies that individual will pursue. And specifically also always putting the nation and the Constitution and oath of office and fundamental things we've learned, like the peaceful transfer of power, always above both the individual's ambitions and also the party's ambitions. And so human beings, the opposite of that demagoguery is when an individual, Donald Trump again is our greatest teacher in this, in the past 50 years, certainly, or the whole history of the country, of the use of fear-mongering, hate-mongering, stereotyping, and racist overtones, sexist overtones, that using these baser elements of human communication and human nature in order to gain office. The sad truth is, as history reveals and the history of democracies reveals, is this tactic or strategy often works to gain attention and gain political power. So I don't think any amount of education, maybe that's an exaggeration, but I think realistically in our country, for example, there's no realistic amount of reform in education in civics and history and ethics starting K through college that could mitigate fully this tendency of human nature to succumb to a cult of personality, a cult of demagogue. So that takes us back to, again, how do we maintain democracy? those in leadership positions in particular must be educated about democracy. They must understand that democracy is, think of it as a layered cake, where there's one layer is this direct democracy or pure democracy concept where the people vote. The next layer is checks and balances. And then after that, you have another source of power that must be checked with checks and balances. So again, most fundamentally important, we have to honor and understand what Hamilton and so many others have said. Beware demagogues. Erect within your system methods to sideline and thwart demagogues at every turn. And again, we've failed in that. We have essentially neutralized the Electoral College, which the founders initially drew up into the Constitution for the purpose of thwarting demagogues. And then, of course, they also instilled within the Constitution, in the event that an authoritarian or demagogue or criminal type gets into power like the presidency, you have impeachment and conviction and disqualification for future office. That's still present and can be powerful, but unfortunately, due to hyperpartisanship, that failed twice with Trump. So all of these are ways to maintain democracy, and sadly, we have not. The last, of course, way to maintain democracy is the rule of law. And at least for the moment, the rule of law, meaning the independent judicial system, studying Trump and studying his behaviors in the 2020 election and before and after, have determined that he committed crimes against the state, crimes against the nation, and they're pursuing that, as you know, with four criminal investigations taking place right now. So all of those are essential ways to, and the last one I would mention is the idea of handing down something my father taught me. My father was a lifelong lawyer and then a federal judge for 44 years. He said the essential thing is we have to hand down the spirit of liberty from one generation to the next. And so as we hand down the spirit of liberty, that also means this protective approach to a democracy and a recognition of what its weaknesses and vulnerabilities are and its Achilles heel, specifically as it relates to the emergence of demagogues into the political system and the corruption that follows that.
And with democracy under threat, would you say that those ways of maintaining it that you described there are also a few of the steps that we need to take to save it?
I think so. And so what you're bringing that up, I mean, it's like a lot of things in this case in particular, if you study democracy, it's much easier said than done, of course. Mm-hmm. And so the operative word becomes reform. It's not uncommon for democracies to march forward into the future and hit walls and hit dangerous walls, in fact. And so that calls upon the necessity of reform. I think too many people believe that a democracy or constitutional democracy is a self-correcting system. And that is really not true. The people and the leadership must embark upon reforms that are both logical to any democracy throughout the world and throughout history, but then also specifically to a specific democracy. Democracies are not all alike. And then historical periods do present brand new challenges, such as the challenge that we're facing now with mass communications and a decentralization of vital information and the purveyance of truth. Again, we can think back to the 70s and 80s when there were three cable networks that all were quite dedicated to ethical practice. They were all quite dedicated to providing the people with the truth in a rational and calm manner. And now compare what we have today. We essentially have a total decentralization and people are confused. Not quite half the country thinks that Donald Trump, won the 2020 election. So I think, we're going to have to adopt and we're going to have to actually, people don't like the word regulate, but it is essential. Governance is essential. And if there's poisons in the system that are going to bring down the system, we have to recognize those things must be channeled and managed somewhat as we've done in the past with various forms of violence and also various forms of hate speech. So one of the, again, at the first summit, one of the world leaders said, and it's always stuck with me, that we're experiencing an explosion of new possibilities and challenges with regard to mass communication and technology. And this individual, I think Guy Parmelon from maybe Switzerland, that one as well. In any event, he said that we must make sure that technology is a net positive and not a net negative for democracy. I think that's just a beautiful way to understand it. Any speech and technology, and especially technology that relates to rhetoric, will always have a downside and positive side. But I think that would push things in the right direction if we do understand that our technology, our communications must have a net positive effect on our democracy instead of a net negative effect. And right now, I don't think there's many people who would disagree that it's a net negative effect.
But some of the issues that we're dealing with are more systemic. They have to do with how democracy itself is set up. But do you think that we as citizens, as civilians, can also play a role collectively in saving democracy? And if so, in what ways?
Of course, I believe that we collectively and we individually have the most important role to play in the world. It's not who has more responsibility, the leadership or the people. Mm-hmm. I would probably come down on the side of the leadership, but I'm more interested in just saying it takes both of those two entities working together, I think, to shore up problems and dangers like those that we have today. And so individually and collectively, folks need to do things. And so, but I will say it's not so easy for people just to decide, oh, well, I need to get involved. I think there's lots of ways to benefit our democracy, and some are more passive and easier, and others are very time consuming. I mean, everything I've done since 2018, I really just view as active citizenship. I identified, you may not know, Ricardo, or your listeners, that I was practicing psychiatry. And I actually long, complex reasons why I've always had sort of defense of constitution, defense of democracy, and the writing of history in my bones. But I made a full pivot from the practice of psychiatry into these areas, really inspired is not the right word, but I'll say, you know, inspired by what happened in the 2016 presidential election. So my active citizenship has been everything from the many op-eds that I've written since 2018 and putting together this collection of quotations, How to Save Democracy, putting together a really wonderful collection of essays. Six or seven are mine, but there's 23 others in there by other people that are truly excellent. And that's called The Curse of Demagogues, Lessons Learned from the Presidency of Donald J. Trump. All of this is my active citizenship. So, but if folks are wondering what they can do individually, I would say, and there's a sense of either inertia or ambivalence, it's enough to just begin to learn about democracy. Just other people will describe the four cornerstones of democracy or the essential elements of democracy, perhaps differently from my own. But once I think citizens build in their mind their own sense of what democracy is, what the house of democracy is, and what your four cornerstones are, I know someone who thinks that one of the four cornerstones must be women's rights. And so that's fine. And so get behind that. I think the way to begin, perhaps, to get active in the defense of our democracy is really to study it first and develop your own working model of what democracy is and what it needs to be. And then perhaps a person can find their way in there. And I would just, again, insist that what democracy is not a house with the four cornerstones and they all are the will of the people. This idea of direct pure democracy, the Athenians practiced that, and it only lasted 100 years, and it ended in absolute disaster at the hands of demagogues and tyrants. The Romans had a much more complex system with more checks and balances, and their system lasted 500 years. Our system, which is replete with checks and balances, has been historically, has now lasted 250 years. So I think that a healthy future will again depend upon restoring checks and balances and most fundamentally ethical leadership. And as I bring that up, I'll share another, really, I think one of my favorite primary source inspirations in all the history I know, it's James Madison. He wrote one of the Federalist Papers too. This one is 57. And I'll paraphrase him. It's just very revealing. He said, the essential aim of a constitution, a political constitution, he said, this is amazing. The essential aim of all of this complexity that we create around government and elections is to elevate to office, he didn't use the word ethical, but he said those who will promote the good of the society. So he really means the principal aim of a democracy is to get ethical leadership in place where those leaders have personality types that are more self-sacrificing, that they're not simply pursuing power for power's sake and their own sake. They're actually, sure, they can be ambitious. They can love to see themselves in the limelight in the newspaper and on CNN and in the news stations, but that have a built-in personality and understanding of what their job is, in this case, in the presidency, and that is to honor the Constitution. That is to honor the peaceful transfer of power and the oath of office and our democratic values and principles. So that's very revealing to understand that at least one very wise constitutional thinker, James Madison, said, you know what all this is all about? Finding the best systems to get ethical people into power. And then even for those most ethical people, have checks and balances because they might themselves get corrupted by power. And if they do, we need to move them out and replace them with a new set of ethical leaders.
So let me ask you just one last question then. If we are really interested in saving democracy, is it enough to try to do it on a country level that is worrying just about democracy in our own countries? Or do we need to expand our view and care about the health of democracy worldwide? Not just because, for example, we live in a more interconnected and interdependent world than ever, but also because perhaps as people who care about democracy, we should also care about the democracy of other countries and the well-being of their own citizens.
Yeah, I think, of course, what's most important is that we do both things. And again, the two summits on democracy, I would say that that probably was the most overriding theme of all, is we need, as Biden made clear in his opening remarks, you know, we really need for each of us to take stock of our own nations and our own house of democracy and work hard to improve and expand opportunity, but also protectiveness within those in terms of the types of officials who gain power. And then at the same time, collaborating with other democracies in order to learn from one another, but also, of course, in order to form coalitions to protect one another. I mean, we think of Ukraine now, we think of Russia and China as the on the opposing side there. And the other thing to recognize is throughout all of the history I know, even when there have been coalitions of liberal nations working together, there have always been leading nations. There have always been those nations who were in the forefront and had the most power and were thought to have the most robust and successful forms of government. And as we also know that over the past at least 75 to 80 years, you know, the United States has been And truly, it's not just narcissism of Americans to think we've been the beacon of constitutional democracy, the beacon of ethical constitutional democracy. But in fact, other countries have looked to us for precisely that. And one thing you discover in both of these most recent summits for democracy is really outcries by smaller democracies that are more vulnerable saying, United States, we need you to pull yourself together. We need you to restore the integrity of democracy. We need to be able to trust and rely that the leadership of the United States will be there. And so those are among the many complexities that the United States really needs. I would say to spend most of its time over the next 10 years focused on shoring up and strengthening and making safe once again our own democracy, while also continuing to do the work of aiding other democracies and learning from other democracies. And some nation needs to emerge as the beacon of democracy. It doesn't need to be the United States. It could be the United States. But in this, these new complexities, as you and I have discussed quite a bit today, with the new challenges of technology-fueled disinformation and demagoguery, some nation or block of nations, such as the European Union, need to find a pathway to success in managing these dangers, and then maybe it will be us emulating them, or vice versa. I have an instinct it might be us emulating them this time around, Ricardo. I don't know what you think.
Well,
how are things in Portugal? I haven't followed that country too well.
Well, I mean, I guess that the biggest issues we are dealing with nowadays are very common, like inflation and climate change, and a little bit of a threat of perhaps some far right-wing parties rising over the next election courses. So I think that those are very unfortunately common issues across the board. So
yeah, the emergence of that's, we haven't mentioned the word you and I today of extremism. But that's another way of describing the ultimate problem that of hyperpolarization and political parties that are not interested in the common good. And then I would just emphasize, maybe as my last point to repeat, that when you let demagogues get the megaphone within a democracy, all it does is exacerbate the extremism by orders of magnitude.
Great. So let's end on that note then. I'm leaving links to your books in the description box of the interview. And apart from the books, just before we go, would you like to tell people where they can find you and your work on the internet?
Yeah, I have a website, but I think folks might be most interested in, for a little over a year, I've had a Substack newsletter called American Commonwealth, in which I write about the challenges to our democracy and some solutions to them, some of the things we've discussed today. And I normally don't write more than three or four a month. I've recently been writing a little less than that because I have been academically busy and also transitioning myself geographically from San Francisco to Nashville, Tennessee. So, but it's easy to sign up there. There's no charge, and you can follow what I'm writing and also give me feedback if you wish.
Great. So, Dr. Merritt, thank you so much again for taking the time to come on the show. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Great. Thank you, Ricardo. Pleasure to speak to you.
Hi, guys. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you like what I'm doing, please consider supporting the show on Patreon and PayPal. The links are in the description down below. And also, please share, like, and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by Enlights Learning and Development Done Differently. Check their website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Perga Larsen, Jerry Muller, Hans Frederick Sunde, Bernardo Seixas, Olaf Alex, Adam Castle, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollis, Erika Lenny, John Connors, Philip Force Connolly, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegger, Rui Nassi, Zup, Mark Neves, Colin Holbrook, Simon Columbus, Phil Kavanagh, Michael Stormier, Samuel Andre, Francis Ford, Iag Nunes, Fergal Cousin, Hal Herzog, Nun Machado, Jonathan Librand, Joel Niars, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, João Eira, Tom Hummel, Sadus France, David Sloan Wilson, Yasila Dez Araújo, Romain Roach, Diego Londonho Correa, Anik Punta, Radana Rosmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pablo Stasevski, Alec Bach, Guy Madsen, Gary G. Hellman, Sam Afzal, Adrian Yegi, Paul Tolentino, João Barbosa, Julian Price, Edward Hall, Edin Bronner, Douglas Fry, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortez, Ursula Litsky, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy, Sunny Smith, John Wiseman, Daniel Friedman, William Buckner, Paul George Arnaud, Luke Loaki, Georgios Theofanos, Chris Williamson, Peter Wolosin, David Williams, Diogo Costa, Anton Eriksson, Charles Morey, Alex Shaw, Amari Martinez, Coralie Chevalier, Bangalore Atheists, Larry Dealey Jr., Old Herringbone, Starry, Michael Bailey, Dan Sperber, Robert Grassis, Igor N., Jeff McMahon, Jake Zuhl, Barnabas Radix, Mark Campbell, Thomas Dobner, Luke Neeson, Chris Story, Kimberly Johnson, Benjamin Gilbert, Jessica Nowicki, Linda Brandon, Nicholas Carlson, Ismael Benzliman, George Coriatis, Valentin Steinman, Paul Crawley, Kate Von Goller, Alexander Hubbard, Liam Dunaway, B.R., Masood Ali Mohammadi, Perpendicular, Jonas Hertner, Ursula Goodenough, Gregory Hastings, and David Pinsoff. A special thanks to my producers, Izar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stefaniak, Tom Vanagdam, Bernard Eugni, Curtis Dixon, Benedict Mueller, Thomas Trumbull, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Giancarlo Montenegro, Alnick Ortiz, Nick Golden, and Rosie. And to my executive producers, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Codrian, and Bogdan Canivet. Thank you for all.